need some water?
What's that?
You have some water?
Yeah, that'd be great, actually.
So how does this work? You clip it like this.
Over your ears.
Like that.
Okay.
And this one goes into your pocket, and you can clip it against your belt.
Yeah. Yeah, a bit. So I can get it. Yeah, I have the same problem trying to wear sunglasses. My head is very large and they don't quite fit.
Okay. It doesn't disturb me. But normally it would go completely over the ear.
Yeah. It does not seem to.
I think you can take it under your hair.
Oh, yeah.
And you want me to do this line forwarding for you and go through the slides, or do you want it yourself?
Oh, yeah, you can do that for me, actually.
All right, I think that's much better.
Yeah. Right?
That looks good.
Okay. Great.
We can clip this against your belt. Oops. Oh, this one of the small.
Okay.
When you start going, we need to clamp on still, which is fine. So this small.
Okay. Oh, wait, oh, it's off.
Sorry?
What do I do? Oh, how do I start?
Just put this one.
Oh, now it's off.
Oh, sorry, it was on.
Oh, okay.
So just need to
push tape. Okay.
Maybe put it in the pocket before it falls down.
Yeah. Good idea. Thank you very much. I'm going to put it some place where it can't be spilled.
Okay, so hello again. I'm welcoming our next speaker, Lee Rivel from New York City, from Brooklyn, as I learned.
Yeah. Philly, actually.
Philly, sorry. Yeah. He's currently my guest in my flat. Lee is a good chance to not only bring in the musician part, but also the really deep kernel hacker part, which he's been for a while.
You're giving me too much credit.
Those of you who are reading the Linux Audio Developers or user mailing list may find that he's pretty active there. I asked him about his mail volume that he produces per day, and he said it might be between 40 and 60. So yes, he is active, and I think today he has his chance to show you that he's a really nice guy and not the person he might appear to be sometimes in the mail.
Oh, man, come on.
Go ahead.
Jeez. All right. Well, I guess. All right. I guess most of you know who I am, the Linux audio user, autoresponder. I've been thinking of replacing myself with the script. You know, I may get a chance to work on that this weekend. But all right, so my talk is about the 2.6 Linux kernel. As many of you know, 2.6 is the current version of the kernel. Previously, Linux audio really began in earnest with the low latency patches for kernel 2.4, which was around, I guess, 2000 or 2001, which gave quite good performance, a millisecond or two, but had a serious disadvantage in that it required a custom kernel in order to do even the most basic, real-time audio stuff. So when 2.6 came along, we were told by the kernel developers, we being the Linux audio community, that the features from the 2.4 low latency patch would be merged. And theoretically, 2.6 would have provided as good latency as a patch 2.4 kernel, which turned out not to be the case. Paul Davis and some other people did some tests and found that the early 2.6 releases were very bad for latency, something like 20 to 50 milliseconds, you know, which is, as many of you know, is not good. So, yeah, go ahead and, okay. Yeah, a little longer. Let's see, where am I? Paul and some other people contacted the kernel developers with these results, and Ingo and other kernel developers took a look, and the result was the voluntary preemption patch for the 2.6.7 kernel, I believe, was the first release. And what they did was went through, let me start over with that. The reason it was called the voluntary preemption patch is because normally if preemption is not enabled in the kernel configuration, there's basically no limit to the, you know, scheduling latencies can be effectively unbounded. And the voluntary part actually refers to adding scheduling points to kernel, adding explicit scheduling points to kernel code paths that could have caused latency issues. But the really interesting part for the Linux audio community who would be using kernels compiled with preemption enabled is the additional scheduling points that were added wherever Ingo and the other kernel developers found a latency over a millisecond. So that's kind of the beginning of the story. The first mechanism to, you know, the first requirement to improving the kernel further for real-time audio use was to determine the source of an underrun, which previously had relied on guesswork, voodoo, magic, you know, whatever you call it. The Alta developers, you know, friendly guys that they are, are they represented here? I guess not. But the Alta developers added an XRun debugging mechanism, which very simply, whenever the Alta kernel layer detected an underrun, it would, as soon as the underrun was detected, would dump the kernel stack, which may or may not provide a clue as to the code path responsible. The problem with that mechanism is that it was unreliable. In a lot of cases, by the time the XRun was detected by the Alta layer, the responsible code was no longer on the stack. So this helped with some issues, but it was not it was kind of a halfway solution. I should go back a little bit and say that now the 2.6 kernel claimed to be fully preemptible. The problem with that is that it really wasn't. It was kernel code could be preempted as long as no spin locks were held, as long as no code had called preempt disable explicitly, or as long as the kernel was not executing code in a hard or soft interrupt context, which not exactly fully preemptible, but you know. Step in the right direction. So, last one, sorry. A little more on this one. Sorry, I'm not even looking at the slides. yes?
Can I just ask something at this point?
Yeah.
Is it easy to describe what preempt means?
Yes, sure. What preempt means is that when a user process executes a system call, you go from user into kernel context. When the system call completes, you return to user context. And in a non-preemptible kernel, it's not possible to schedule another process until that system call has returned. So for example, if you had a high priority audio process running alongside a low priority process of any type, and the low priority process executed a system call, then the high priority process, even if the high priority process became runnable immediately after the low priority process executed the system call, then the high priority process would have to wait. And the upshot of that is you get an audio dropout. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. Please feel free to stop me if I use any kernel speak that anyone would like clarified. Okay. A spin lock is a mechanism that's used in the kernel to protect data. And what happens is if two processes want to access the same data, the first process takes the spin lock, and if the second process comes along and tries to access the same data while the spin lock is still held, the second process will spin in a loop, eating all your CPU until the first process is done. It sounds like this would be really, really bad, but spin locks are designed to be held for very short periods of time. So much less than a millisecond. That wasn't always the case, which I'll get to in a minute. But if you talk to the kernel guys, they'll say never hold a spin lock for more than a couple hundred microseconds. Okay. So so where were we? So the ALSA underrun debug mechanism was not sufficient. A few bugs were found with it, but we quickly hit the point where it didn't produce any more useful output, but we were still getting X runs. So Ingo developed a latency tracer, which, when enabled, would cause every kernel function call to be recorded, such that when you detect an X run, well, actually, it's not based on X run detection, but it would cause every kernel function call to be recorded, such that it would cause every function call with preemption disabled to be recorded. So, in effect, if something disables preemption, runs a bunch of code, and then later re-enables it, it records the amount of time spent with preemption disabled, and if that was longer, then the longest previously recorded time would save it in a buffer for you to look at later. So the effect of this was that if you got an X run, rather than having to guess, you could look at the kernel's latency tracer output, and it would tell you, you'd see a bunch of disk driver related functions in there, and now you know that the disk controller, the disk driver needs some work. Whew. So. Anyway, so once we had this mechanism, this allowed us to find all kinds of latency problems that couldn't have been found before or would have had to have been found by luck. So now I'm going to list a bunch of them. And please feel free to ask questions if any of this is unclear. One of the first issues we found was that Riser FS 3.x, contrary to popular belief, was very bad for latency. And the reason for that was that other file systems, such as ext3, would use their own fine-grained locking, utilizing spin locks and whatnot, which, like I said, ideally would result in latencies of a couple hundred microseconds at worst. However, Riser FS3 was never ported to use proper locking. rather than implementing per data structure locks, it ended up just using the big, quote-unquote, big kernel lock for everything. All the big kernel lock was that rather than a spin lock, which protects a certain protects a certain data structure, the big kernel lock just locks everything. What this was basically a shortcut in order to get Linux, in order to implement SMP support on Linux without having to go into every single driver and analyze the locking and add spin locks as necessary. So the upshot of this was that the Riser FS3 was very bad, and as it was in maintenance mode, wasn't fixed. So we quickly found out that if you wanted low latency, you had to use ext3 FS or another. I'm not familiar with the latency characteristics of anything other than Riser and ext3. Maybe some of you use XFS or something like that and may know something about that. But so basically, you want good latency, had to switch to ext3. The next big problem we found was IDE drivers. When an I/O operation occurred, the IDE driver ended up doing all of the work in hardware interrupt context. In hardware interrupt context, preemption is disabled. Nothing else can happen until we return from the interrupt. So, and this could cause latencies of 20, 30 milliseconds, fairly bad. So the fix for this was, rather than reworking the IDE subsystem to do all that work in a different context, a work queue or something like that, which would have required a lot of re-architecture of the IDE driver, which none of the kernel developers had time for, we added a SysFS. Next slide. Yeah, a SysFS tunable to limit the amount of I/O that could be handled in a single hardware interrupt. So the result of this was that if you had Jack waiting to run and a big I/O request came in, rather than making Jack wait till that was finished, the I/O would be split up into smaller chunks, and a smaller chunk of I/O was handled with each interrupt. So rather than transferring 32 megabytes with a single interrupt, you would get 32 interrupts and transfer 1 megabyte each, which makes, it has a performance cost, obviously, but we need latency more than we need performance. So that ended up being quite an effective mechanism, and it's actually not as well known as it should be. I suspect that the IDE issue is responsible for a lot of the mysterious latency problems that people run into. So I guess the fix for that is just to get the distributions to use better defaults, something, not sure. What's that?
Wait a second.
Yeah.
Is there a good documentation on what parameters to tune?
There's my paper. Yeah, I'm not sure that it's documented. That's actually a good point. Then again, if it was documented, it would be documented in the kernel source documentation, which most users find inaccessible. Yeah. So, a lot of them don't even bother because half of it's goes back to 2.2 and never got updated or whatever. Okay, so the IDE issue was solved in that way. One of the funniest latency problems I came across involved toggling caps lock, scroll lock, anything that changed the state of an LED on the keyboard. When you hit caps lock, the keyboard driver would actually spin in the interrupt context, waiting for to read back that the state of the LED on the keyboard had changed. So you could just cause xrun after xrun by just hitting caps lock. So, not very good. Not very good. So that was quickly and quietly fixed, and nothing much more was ever said about it. But it was fixed by moving the polling into a work queue, which can be scheduled on another processor. All right, so the next category of latency problems we found, I've kind of lumped the VFS, which is the virtual file system layer, and VM, the virtual memory layer, into the same category. They don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, just because many, many problems were found in both of these subsystems, too many to, you know, go through here right now. But the upshot of that, or the effect, was that you could trigger lots of X runs by doing things like a heavy disk benchmark, or even a process allocating a couple hundred megabytes of RAM and exiting. The kernel would do things like disable preemption while waiting for all 200 megabytes, you know, to be written out, or something along those lines. I'm not really going to get into too many details here because it's probably boring and I'd probably get it wrong. An example of a problem like this that we found was I found while developing an ULSA driver that required two instances of Jack. Actually, Jack didn't require this, but at the time it wasn't clear from the Jack documentation that you could run two separate Jack processes, one for the capture device and one for the playback device. And what I found is that if you started a Jack process for the playback device, started another Jack instance for the capture device, you would get a massive dropout in the first one. And this was caused by Jack's use of mlockall, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with. It instructs the kernel that not to swap out Jack's memory under any circumstances. But this had the unfortunate effect that calling mlockall from one process would take a spin lock and tell the virtual memory system to fault in all of those pages. So that was not good. And I don't remember exactly how that one was fixed. Yes, that is fixed. That was fixed about a year and a half ago or something. Yes, that one was fixed. I guess.
I was wondering, because in a typical audio setup, you'd have all kinds of processes using mlockall all the time. Probably.
Yes, exactly. And the performance was very bad as a result. So that one's been solved as far as I know. There may be a couple of corner cases where an mlockall could cause underruns in an unrelated process, but there's none left that I know of. All right, so let's see. Yeah, too many small problems here to list and not enough detail. That covers the hardware interrupt issues and the process context issues, VFS, VM, things like that, file systems. Which brings us to soft IRQs, which were a big, messy problem. What a soft IRQ is when, maybe I'll come back to that or something. I don't want to spend too long on it. What a soft IRQ is when an interrupt occurs, is each interrupt handler has a defined amount of work to do. For example, audio interrupts, audio, that's actually a little tricky. Disk is easier. A disk interrupt happens, and you have to transfer all that data from the disk before the interrupt can be deasserted. And the problem with doing all of the interrupt handler work in hardware interrupt context is that a heavy interrupt load, like for example, you know, a web server that's getting just pounded with requests, if you do too much work in each interrupt, then lots of interrupts will basically bring the system to its knees. So the kernel deals with that by running only the minimal amount of code in hardware interrupt context required to by running as little code as possible in the hardware interrupt and deferring the rest of the work to what's called a soft IRQ, which can be run later on another CPU or something like that. So the effect of that is to increase the interrupt load we can handle before the machine falls over. The problem with that is that soft IRQs normally end up executing immediately after the interrupt handler returns. It's only under extreme load that soft IRQs will be deferred. And soft IRQ context also disables preemption. So you're back to the same problem. If Jack's running and a network interrupt comes in, then Jack cannot run until the network driver has, you know, processed that packet or those packets or does whatever it needs to do. Fortunately, Linux has a mechanism where under high load, rather than executing the soft IRQ handler immediately on the same processor after the hardware interrupt returns, all soft IRQs can be deferred to a thread called soft IRQD. And the reason for that was scalability for things like big servers and whatnot. That has a fortunate side effect that soft IRQs that are run from the soft IRQD daemon can be preempted, unlike normal soft IRQs. So since this mechanism was already used automatically by the kernel under high load, it was a fairly simple modification to have the kernel always run soft IRQs in that thread, regardless of the load, which greatly improved the latency. So, and there's lots of places in the kernel that use soft IRQs. The networking subsystem is by far the biggest. Also, SCSI uses them, kernel timers, things like that. And which actually brings me to the one significant unfixed problem, which is route cache flushing. It's when the kernel maintains a cache of network routes, which can grow to be very, very large, and every 10 minutes or every 5 minutes or something like that, it's flushed. And due to the design, the way that the network system is designed, there's no way to reduce the amount of work done in the route cache. By the route cache flush, you can't tell it to flush more often. You can't. There's no workaround basically, and this is actually still an open issue with the latest 2.6 kernels. Eric Dumazet, one of the Linux network developers, has proposed a mechanism to fix it, but it's very, very complicated, and I'm not even going to try to explain it here. I'm not exactly a networking expert. So, another category of latency problems we found were simply places where the kernel was doing too much work because it was using an inefficient algorithm. For example, kallsim's lookup, which is called when any time the kernel has to resolve an address to a function name. For example, printk, stack dumps, you know, anything like that. So, Any time the kernel had to look up a symbol, it would end up doing a linear search over all of them, which was very bad. I think Paulo Marquez was his name. Simply switched the kernel from using that to using a more efficient search method, which eliminated the latency issues associated with printk, stack dumping, that kind of thing. And, okay, so I think you can actually, yeah, next slide. Sorry, am I going too fast? the last category of issues that, that we discovered were, hardware driver interactions that would actually cause not just preemption to be disabled, but the entire machine to freeze for 20, 30 milliseconds. I discovered this when I found that moving around the mPlayer window while Jack was running would just cause a constant stream of not even X runs, because an X run depends on the kernel's ability to keep time. It has to be able to tell that too much time has passed since some event. But since this bug actually caused the processor to effectively stall, Jack would report, I don't remember the exact message, excessive delay, something. It would basically get horribly confused and complain loudly. Yeah. So anyway, we looked into this a little. I contacted the author of the driver and found out that the way that this video card worked is, or the way that all video cards work really, is that there's a command register and a status register, and when you want to, when the X server, you know, wants to tell the video card, you know, move this, you know, move this, I'm not a graphics guy, I don't know the exact term, move this rectangle over, you know, 10 pixels or something like that, the X server just tells the hardware to do it, and the hardware does it without the kernel being involved at all. It's actually the one area of the kernel where hardware access is not mitigated by the kernel. User space X server talks directly to the hardware. And it turns out that what the problem was that this driver, which had come from the vendor originally via, in order to improve benchmark scores, rather than checking the status register before sending more commands to the video card, it would just send the commands to the card without checking that the card was ready to accept them. And the effect of that was what I just described, the machine would stall until the card was ready to accept more data. It's actually kind of interesting because I first read about this symptom in a Microsoft research paper from 1999 or so. It was called A Latency Study of Windows NT. It's highly recommended. Like almost everything in it correlates with something I'm describing, you know, that we fixed with 2.6. It turned out to be the exact same problem that was described in that Microsoft paper 6 years ago. And the exact same cause, you know, namely vendors writing bad drivers to improve benchmark scores. Yeah. So we fixed that one, and I was actually expecting to find more problems like that, but it turns out that it was only the VIA Unichrome driver affected. Maybe some of you can, you know, have a counterexample, but no more problems like that were found. So that basically covers all of the latency improvements that have been made to the mainline kernel between about 2.6.7 and the latest version 2.6.16. Now, as many of you know, most of you may be using the RT kernel, which was basically originally was a staging ground for lots of these improvements to get into the mainline kernel. And later, you know, Ingo took it even farther by adding IRQ threading and, you know, all these Solaris-like features, you know, to really make the kernel fully preemptible. And I'm not going to go extensively into the RT kernel because that's a whole other topic. I'm kind of been focused on mainline. So anyway, the upshot of all this was that between 2.6.7 and 2.6.14, the worst case latency improved from about 20 to 50 milliseconds to 2 to 5 milliseconds, which is quite adequate for, you know, almost everything we're doing here. The reason I said 2.6.14 is because there have been a few slight regressions since then. Fortunately, they're very small, and they're actually overshadowed by the route cache flushing issue that I mentioned before. We're not interested in the average latency; we care about the worst case. So those can be fixed event once we deal with the route caching issue. Knock on wood. In conclusion, the 2.6 kernel, recent versions of the 2.6 kernel, should be perfectly adequate for almost all audio use. There are a couple applications that want like millisecond latency, you know, half a millisecond, things like that. The example I use is I'm a guitar player, and if the tactile feedback, which requires really, really, really low latency, because if the tactile feedback does not match exactly what you're hearing, even if it's off by a millisecond or something, it's just weird. It's hard to play like that. It kind of gives you the effect of, I don't know, it's strange. It's hard for me to explain to a keyboard player because they're used to, you know, some mechanical latency. But it's for guitar requires very, very low latency. So one of the significant implications of this you know, this odyssey here, I think, is that it vindicates the new kernel development process. As some of you may know, the new kernel development process is that the first priority is to have the best kernel there is, and everything else, such as API stability, things like that, are secondary. And if that model had not been adopted, then the 2.6 kernel would still be very bad. It was only the rapid development process that Ingo, Andrew, and Linus have recently introduced with 2.6 that made all this possible. So, very good. And another lesson I found is that, as I mentioned before, almost everything I've described here was already discovered by Sun in the 80s and Microsoft in the 90s. So we do have a bit of a case of history repeating itself here. But fortunately, you know, we have an open source development paradigm, so now that we're caught up, the sky's the limit. And I think that's about it. I think there's probably going to be quite a few questions because I kind of blazed through some fairly technical topics. So are there any?
Jeff Beasley, Australia.
Hi.
Hey, when we get back, we're going to rebuild three machines.
Okay.
Okay. We've got 2.612 R4s currently, and we're getting in the order of three. Oh no, I think we're running about 128 by two periods. So we're getting whatever that gives us. What's that about? Is that two or
I think
or five.
Depends
milliseconds.
On your sample rate, actually.
Yeah. At 48 we're running. Yeah. So yes, it is. It's about 5 milliseconds, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But we get occasional X runs and so forth, which are a nuisance with samplers. So essentially, the question is, I've seen in the latest kernel they have with the Ingo Molnar patches, the real-time preemption, is that relatively recent? Because the previous, I'd only seen the desktop one, which obviously doesn't give you quite what we need.
Yeah.
So do we need to still apply the Ingo Molnar patch, or is it now in the kernel?
The Ingo Molnar patch is not in the kernel yet. Right. Or the key feature, which is the real-time preemption part, is not in the kernel. The key feature of the real-time preemption patch being that anything is preemptible, regardless, like all the rules I previously mentioned, BKL, spin locks, whatnot, you can be preempted regardless of any of those. But for that latency, I would say try 2.6.14. 2.6.14 was actually probably the best mainline kernel for latency. There's been some slight regression since then, but you may still get bumps of 5 to 10 milliseconds from the route cache issue. I suspect that on a very fast machine, those might not be significant. But I haven't tested that on a wide enough variety of hardware to know how dependent it is on processor speed.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Another question.
Victor Lazarin from Ireland. Since we seem to be troubleshooting our machines, so I'll take the opportunity to ask you a localized question. The laptop I'm using for performance at the moment, I have the AC97 sound that comes with it, and then I was looking for the best or good bargain on a USB sound card, so I got this Tascam sound card, but it's and I don't know what the problem is. It might be a problem with the OUSA driver, rather than anything. Just the latency with it, the same kernel, basically 2.615 mm-hmm. with DRT preemption.
Mm-hmm.
I can only get something like the minimum buffer I can get is 640 samples, whereas with the AC97 sound card, I can go down to 64 samples. Or
I think that's
128.
Yeah. It sounds to me like since the other card can go down to 64, that would be a driver issue maybe,
mm-hmm.
Or an issue with the USB controller on your machine or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to say. I'm not exactly a USB audio expert.
But there will be so beyond the kernel there will be a lot of issues that will affect the.
Yes. Yes. You're right. Not as much with PCI sound cards. For the most part, those will work down to the hardware limits. But there have been a bunch of issues with various USB controllers where you would have latency problems with an OHCI device and not with an EHCI controller, things like that. It's really hard to say. There are a lot of unresolved problems. The PCI sound card problem, is mostly solved, but there are remaining issues with USB, FireWire, that stuff.
Other questions? Stephen Saffer from Canada. Okay. I'm just wondering, when you were measuring this latency, were there kind of typical projects that you were using, numbers of channels, things like that?
For the most part, I was doing these tests while I was developing the multi-channel feature for the Sound Blaster Live cards. Most people don't know those cards actually are multi-channel inside. They were originally designed to support a digital audio workstation in the 90s. So I was developing that driver and in the course of my testing with that, trying to figure out whether it was a driver problem or a kernel problem, that was the main project that I ended up doing, most of these discoveries on.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else? Yeah. Maybe from the internet something?
Yeah.
No, not yet. Frank.
All right.
Frank Neumann, Karlsruhe, Germany.
Hey. Really?
The question was somewhat asked by Geoff already, yeah. But for an average Linux dummy like I am,
mm-hmm.
how do I find out EZD which of the 2.6.x kernels is suitable for me?
It's kind of hard to say because lots of these issues depend. The kernel changes so fast, and lots of these things like the hardware and software interrupt stuff is dependent on the driver set that you're using. So it's still very hard to systematically test all of this and say that there are no latency problems in the kernel because you're limited to the set of drivers for the hardware you have available. Yeah, so it's really hard to say. I mean, I found that 2.6.14 was the best in terms of generic issues, things like the virtual file system, virtual memory, things that are common to every Linux system. But beyond that, you're still going to have to just try them. there's still a ways to go.
And a follow-up question on this one,
mm-hmm.
Does all of this apply to only IA32, or what about my new AMD 64 machine? Will it also benefit from all these patches?
Yes, it should all apply equally to AMD 64, but I don't have one of those machines. I haven't really tested it. I have seen some anecdotal reports that latency, that AMD 64 has some latency problems that IA32 doesn't have. But without the hardware, I haven't really been able to follow up much on that. I mean, I haven't seen any definitive bug reports that would indicate that it's any different. So.
Well, that raises another question then, Lee. If you're building a 32 kernel on a 64 machine,
mm-hmm.
are you likely to find anything like what you described then? Because we've got two machines in there, both AMD 64s, but we don't build 64-bit kernels on them.
Hmm.
So that's another thorny one, isn't it?
None of these latency problems should apply. All of these latency issues I've described should apply equally to 32 and 64-bit systems. So it should not matter. Emphasis on should. Yeah.
So, any
question.
Yeah, now Jan from the internet.
Okay, yes. Okay, this might probably already have been answered due to, yeah, network lag. L-Factor from the IRC was just asking me to ask for a 64-bit architectures, and he seems to be like 30 seconds or a minute behind, so that's already crapped up. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, hard to say is the answer to that one, yeah. Yeah. If someone wants to donate me some hardware, I'll look into it.
Okay, so I think that were all the questions, so thank you very much, really well. And now we have 10 minutes break, and we start at 4 o'clock with Ospian Sabe. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, you liked it.
Yeah.
And the lights or the excitement?
I think it's all of it. I have, you know, stage fright and the lights, basically. I sweat like a pig anyway.
Okay, and I think you're doing this. I guess it's really difficult, so a specific topic to present it for normal people like me to gain something.
You think you did? Oh, wow.
Next time, give me a few more hints when I have to do the next slide.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I was kind of.